Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 3, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing a new book titled Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of the Article 1 Initiative at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us the book's author, Professor Barry Friedman from the New York University School of Law, Professor Oren Kerr from the George Washington University Law School, and our moderator, John Malcolm, who is the director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and the Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I will turn it over to John Malcolm to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for speaking with us. John, the floor is yours.
Terrific. Thank you, Nate, and thanks to everybody for calling in. So as Nate just said, we're here to discuss some very important issues raised in a new book, which is titled Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission by Professor Barry Friedman. The fundamental thesis of the book is that the public has allowed itself to become complacent with respect to demanding greater transparency and accountability from our law enforcement and intelligence officials when it comes to surveillance techniques and the use of technology in force, and that this has led to distrust and some bad consequences, or at least surprising revelations, and some loss of our liberty. Professor Friedman also argues that courts have been somewhat complicit in this process, and his prescription is that the public should demand and is entitled to greater transparency and a greater say about the deployment of such techniques and technologies. Now, after brief introductions from me, we will first hear from Barry Friedman and then followed up by comments from Oren Kerr. Barry Friedman is a graduate of the University of Chicago and Georgetown Law School, and then he clerked for Judge Phyllis Kravitch on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. He's a constitutional and criminal law scholar at NYU Law School, having previously been in private practice at Davis Polk and having taught at Vanderbilt Law School. He's also been a visiting scholar at universities in Italy, France, and Hong Kong. No hardship duty there. And he's also the founding director of the Policing Project at NYU Law, which is devoted to helping bring principles of democratic governance and data-driven best practices to policing, which is at the heart of the book that we will be discussing today. He's also the reporter of the American Law Institute's new Principles of Law Police Investigations, and in the interest of full disclosure, Oren and I serve on an advisory group to that project. In addition to the book we'll be discussing today, Barry is also the author of The Will of the People: How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. After we hear from Barry, we will hear from Oren Kerr, who is well known to this group. Oren got his undergraduate degree from Princeton, he has a master's in mechanical engineering from Stanford, and got his law degree from Harvard. He clerked for Judge Leonard Garth on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. He also worked as a trial attorney in the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section at the U.S. Department of Justice and as a special counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's a nationally recognized scholar of criminal procedure and computer crime law. He teaches, as you heard, at George Washington University Law School, where he's also the director of the Cybersecurity Law Initiative. He joined the faculty in 2001, and since then, his publications have been cited in over 2,500 articles and more than 250 judicial opinions. He's also been a visiting professor at the University of Chicago and the University of Pennsylvania, although I'm quite sure he'd be receptive to offers to teach in Italy, France, and Hong Kong, as Barry has done. And with that, Barry, let me turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, John. Those were hardship posts. I'm very, very, very happy to be here, and I'm grateful to you and to Oren and to the Federalist Society for arranging this. As you know, I'm in Durham, North Carolina right now talking about the book. So I thought what I'd do is I'd give a quick overview of the book because it really has three distinct parts to it, and then I'd dig down deep in one of the arguments, the one that's at the front about democratic policing. I'm going to cheat a little bit the middle part of the book on the constitutional aspects of policing, but I'll say a word, and if Oren wants to direct me there or we want to have some of our exchange and then pause and come back to the argument, I'm glad to talk about some of that as well. The book, I'll tell you, is full of stories about policing gone off the rails. Some of them are quite painful to read. Stories about SWAT raids that result in people's dogs being shot or worse. Stories about people being forcibly catheterized. Stories about an elderly African American couple that are seated on an embankment while the police, for no good reason, go through their automobile, their van, and force her, essentially, because they won't let her use the porta potty that she's got, to soil herself in front of them and her husband. And I always say at the beginning of discussions about the book that I want to be clear about where I'm pointing fingers, and I think you nailed it exactly right, John. So, you know, I work with the Policing Project. We work on a daily basis with police officials, both rank and file and brass. I've met many extraordinary people through that process. I do think that there are problems in policing that we as a society should tackle, and we are working hard to tackle them. But to the extent that there are villains in the book, and this is not a book that really has villains, but to the extent there are villains, I point my finger at the judiciary, which I think has done an appalling job of regulating policing, though I think there are structural reasons for that. I mean, it's not, I think, the judges are being woefully bad at it. And then I point a finger at all the rest of us. And that argument about a failure of democratic policing is what constitutes the first third of the book, and I'll come back to it in just a moment. In the second third, after I make the case that we all should be involved in and taking responsibility for policing agencies and their work, I turn to constitutional policing, and in a series of chapters, I make the argument that there ought to be warrants when police whenever it's possible, that the correct standard for most policing is probable cause. I then tackle what I think is the biggest problem of sort of constitutional law at the moment, which is the new policing that is deterrent-based. Think about airport security, where obviously it would make no sense whatsoever to talk about probable cause in a warrant, and some people do believe that, you know, it's unconstitutional, things like that, as general warrants, and I argue that that's wrong, but that we need a completely different set of protections that the courts have failed to apprehend, largely involving generality of searches, or, and then the last chapter of that section, how to deal with searches aimed at groups, things like racial profiling. And then the end of the book, the last third, tackles what I call the real problems of 21st century policing, which are technology and terrorism. I talk about databases and the third-party doctrine, what constitutes a search, and some of the national security issues that we faced. But I'm going to focus now, if I may, on the front part of the book, which is about democratic policing. And there, you know, when I give a talk with PowerPoint, I tell some of the stories that I alluded to at the beginning, show images of those types of policing. I include drones and bulk data collection and SWAT raids and forced catheterization. And I ask everybody, what do all these things have in common? We don't think about them as having anything in common. We look at them as separate problems. There's a problem about racial profiling, or there's a problem about what the surveillance state should look like, or there's a problem about, you know, militarization. And for me, though, they're all basically at bottom the same problem. And the problem is that we've had a failure of democratic accountability around policing, and that's something that I'm working very hard with the Policing Project to try to address. Now, to make that plain, I actually draw a distinction between what I call front-end and back-end accountability. And my great wish in life is that I had thought about that prior to the book being published. But the distinction is an important one in the sense that most of government operates with a great deal of front-end accountability and then a little bit on the back-end, and policing operates with just a little bit on the front-end and almost everything on the back. What do I mean by that? So if you just think, you know, about how government operates in most areas other than foreign affairs, and operates, frankly, at the federal, state, and local level, though the forms of these things might differ, there are certain kind of basics. They're so basic that we just take them for granted. We don't think about them a lot unless there's a fight that's then instantiated in doctrine. So the basics are this. When the executive branch acts, there are rules in place before officials act. The rules are transparent. We know what they are. The rules are formulated with public input. There's an opportunity for people or interest groups or stakeholders to have a say. And finally, we try as best we can to make sure that the rules do more good than harm. The most formal instantiation of that, of course, is cost-benefit analysis. And that's, you know, largely how government runs. It's not particularly controversial. Sometimes it runs better, sometimes it runs worse. But then on the back end, we've got judicial review, which is the primary back-end tool for when things go wrong. In policing, it's just the opposite. So we don't have a lot of front-end. We have a little. There are some congressional statutes, particularly in the technology area, where Orrin is, you know, obviously one of the nation's leading experts. There are some episodic state statutes, though they're not consistent from state to state about what's regulated by statute and what's not, and huge swaths of policing are unregulated at all. And we put all of our emphasis on the back end. So there's inspectors general and auditors and court-appointed monitors and civilian review boards, judicial review, and body cameras, I explained, are also a form of back-end accountability. And the problem with back-end accountability is that it's not very effective without a front-end, and sometimes can be counterproductive. So what back-end is supposed to do is identify where there's been misconduct, where things have gone off the rails in whatever area of government we're talking about. But what we need to do up front is say what we want the rails themselves to look like, what's permissible conduct. And here we need to, you know, bring the public in to see that that is done. And I make a number of arguments about why that's important, everything from transparency, which might be sort of esoteric, but I think is extremely important, to minimizing discretion, minimizing harm, making sure there's really a problem that needs to be solved. And I also argue that this form of front-end involvement is both important in the sense that when there is front-end involvement, policy actually changes, whether it's the rules around militarization after Ferguson, or bulk data collection by the NSA, or how we're treating drones when the public is involved. Rules often change, which suggests that there's a sort of a democratic deficit here. And then I argue that when I give this as a talk, that it's important for the police that to the extent that there are concerns about legitimacy and trust, those are very often addressed by bringing the community in. I find that constantly in our work with the policing project. Now, I acknowledge, and I think it's an important thing to talk about, that policing is different than the rest of government. There's often a need for secrecy around policing that we don't have in other areas. And so you do have to figure out what's the line there and how to work it. And I think it's a tough but interesting question, and one we've obviously talked about in ALI some. So that's I think, a concession to the difference of policing. But that's basically the idea. And this probably isn't the right point, but I hope you'll find 2 or 3 minutes for me, John, at some point to talk about the work that the Policing Project is doing. But I think that's probably enough of a setup for Orrin, who hopefully has made his way from his Uber into a quiet place, and can now jump in.
Orrin?
Yes. So thank you very much for the opportunity to respond to Barry. It's a fascinating book. I enjoyed it greatly. I saw a little bit of it in a pre-publication form and was looking at it again post-publication. So I had a couple thoughts on the argument. One, I think, is that what you make of the argument may depend in part on what the baseline is for how much protection the law of criminal procedure should provide. So here's, I think, a difficulty. If you take the baseline as being that the Supreme Court, in providing the set of Fourth Amendment rules, sort of didn't do a good job, in that perspective, you need democratic rulemaking because the courts haven't done enough. And one difficulty, I think, with the book is that it presupposes that the courts have done a terrible job. I think, as Barry put it, the courts have done an appalling job. There was this golden moment of the Warren Court briefly in the 1960s, but for the most part, the Supreme Court has sort of not done its job at providing sufficient Fourth Amendment protections. And so then that creates the role of legislation and democratic policing. One difficulty, though, is what if you approach these problems from a different assumption about how much privacy and how much restriction on government there should be? And so we saw, for example, the current president of the United States takes the view that there should be more law and order. And generally speaking, from the conservative standpoint, you know, we think of sort of classic conservative judges, justices like Chief Justice Rehnquist, pretty law enforcement oriented. Maybe Justice Alito would be that on the current Supreme Court. And so one difficulty is that if you take that view of the world, just sort of thinking about how to balance privacy and security from a different point, sort of looking more from the perspective of the police, less from the perspective of the defendant in a criminal case or citizen in a civil case, you know, from that perspective, I think people would say, well, the system's actually working pretty well. And the Supreme Court didn't get it all wrong. Actually, they're balancing security and privacy roughly correctly. And how do you then sort of step back and say one of these views is right and the other one is wrong, or is it all just a value judgment? So, you know, in the context of democratic policing, for example, we might all agree, and I certainly agree, that it would be ideal for the public to step forward and say, we want the following statutory limits on law enforcement. And to the extent that democratic rulemaking, I think we'd all agree, is a sort of generally a superior form of regulating the police than the courts. And so why don't people do that? And one way is the book suggests that people don't do that because they've sort of been asleep at the wheel. You know, they're not stepping up and doing their job. Another way of thinking about it is that maybe the public doesn't want added regulation to the police, or maybe in some communities they want added regulation and in other communities they don't. In a federal system, you can, I think, resolve that by saying, well, some communities should have that and other communities should not have that, sort of have just different answers state by state or city by city, with some places getting a lot of regulation, some places not getting a lot of regulation, and it's up to the democratic system to provide that. But it strikes me as a challenge to the thesis of the book that it may be that in some communities the answer to what democratic policing looks like or what democratic constitutionalism looks like, what do the people want, is actually the people want either the status quo or maybe the people want less regulation of the police than the Supreme Court has imposed. So, for example, maybe the public doesn't think Miranda rights are a good idea. Well, the courts have said that's not up to the public. That's something that the courts have decided, and so that takes that off the table. Well, if you really believe in democratic rulemaking, I wonder what do we do with the fact that the Supreme Court has foreclosed a bunch of options that the public might want? And one, you know, reading the book, I think to myself, well, I wonder, you know, was the Supreme Court wrong to, say, incorporate the Fourth Amendment and apply it to the states? So you wonder what the world would have looked like if the Fourth Amendment had only applied to the federal government, which was the design until the mid-20th century when the Supreme Court said that the Fourth Amendment applies to the states. You could have had a world of democratic rulemaking where the Supreme Court stayed out, and that would have invited statutory regulation, and you'd have primarily statutory rules. And I think actually that's what you had in policing until the 1950s, where there was a lot of focus in the early criminal procedure cases on what the statutes had authorized. And once the Supreme Court steps in the 1950s and really is regulating police practices through the Fourth Amendment, I think that largely disappears, or at least that kind of conversation is diminished once the courts step in. So one possibility is maybe the Supreme Court was wrong to step into state and local police practices in the 1950s, which really kind of, I think, once the courts step in, they make the legislature lazy. They make the public lazy because there's a sense that, you know, the courts have taken care of this problem. And so in thinking about the broad thesis of the book, I come back to that baseline problem of, you know, do you need to agree with a certain amount of police regulation? Do you need to have sort of certain substantive commitments for the argument about democratic policing and the role of the public in adding more privacy rights and limits on law enforcement, for that to really resonate? Or is it an argument that can apply regardless of your policy views ultimately about how you would ideally want to balance privacy and security?
Derek, do you want a chance to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd love to, actually, because I think that's super rich. And there's.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I cut you off, Oren? I didn't mean to do that.
No, I was done. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I think Oren's comments are super rich, and I actually would like to respond because I think that there's a shot at some real and meaningful common ground here. I want to start by just disagreeing with one thing vehemently that Oren said, and then I'm going to agree with a lot of the rest. So the thing that I would disagree about is, you know, Oren says, what's the baseline? How do we think about privacy versus security? You know, is it from the perspective of the police or the criminal defendant or a civil plaintiff? I mean, none of that is right. We should be thinking about the balance between privacy and security and any other values that are in there. And those are not the only two from our perspective, from our perspectives as people who live here, as citizens who have views about policy. And I think that's essential. Now, where I'll jump in from there and agree with Oren actually is, you know, it's worth thinking about why the courts have done a lousy job. I think it's largely structural and not crazy. So first, most of the time when they see, you know, for example, Fourth Amendment stuff, which is what I'm primarily interested in personally, it's in exclusionary hearings. And in exclusionary hearings, you know, whatever the cops did,
You might argue about whether it was constitutional or not, but they found the evidence. And the cops look like geniuses. And what the courts can't possibly have is, you know, all the false negatives, the full scope of understanding about what police practices look like and how they occur. And in addition, as Oren correctly points out, you know, judicial review is a one-way ratchet. I mean, it says no or yes. There's some in between, but it's mostly no or yes. And if it's no to the police, then they just can't do it. I mean, no matter what we think about the court getting it wrong, we're stuck. And so the court gets kind of a bad data set. It errs rightfully on the side of the police because that, you know, is what needs to be done. That should leave room for regulation. I want to make an argument for regulation very briefly, but and so I agree with Oren about that. But then the question is, what fills the space and how does it get filled? And I do find it intriguing. I actually have never thought about this as much, and Oren might be right. It's an interesting question to look at, which is whether you get less state lawmaking at the time the Warren Court steps in. So there's a lot of sympathy there. Where I think it's important for people who talk about this but don't deal with the realities of policing, you know, just sort of your ordinary person on the street who hears this issue debated in terms of a, you know, less filling, taste great fight over what policy should be, to realize that it would never make any sense to run a sophisticated 20th century, 21st century police department with a tiny little bundle of constitutional rules. It just doesn't work that way. So I was just on this panel talking about use of force, and, you know, the court's doctrine on use of force says, well, look, we just want to see whether what the officer did was objectively reasonable at the time that it happened. But anybody who works in policing knows that's, and there's a big fight about this with many in policing wanting to stick with that principle because it's very permissive. But, you know, if you want to look at uses of force and you really want to prevent deadly force, for example, you don't just look at the moment that a shooting happened. You backtrack. You say, what could have happened before that that would have kept us from getting to this point? And you have protocols and procedures, just like I'm sure the military does. And so there's a ton of space that needs to be filled. And at present, it's filled by policing agencies without any input from the public often, sometimes not even filled by policing agencies. I mean, they're just big, vast areas of discretion where there's no policy. And the real challenge here, frankly, is where I'll wrap up is how to get that policy. I mean, a lot of the departments don't have the capacity to do it. Most of the departments in this country are tiny. And so that's challenging. The one thing I do want to just indicate, which has become so prominent in our work with the policing project, where we work with communities and the police to kind of bring the community voice in, is that, and you get a wide, you know, range of things that the community has to say, but is to figure out a model to do that. And there's a legislative model, which is largely what Oren and I have been talking about, but that's not the half of it. There are administrative models. Los Angeles has a police commission, which is the only civilian-led police commission that operates as such in the country and actually has the power it does over policy. But we're even working with departments to try to build up capacity within them to act as the expert administrative agency to do some of this themselves. And then there's just much more informal ways for the public to weigh in, whether it's Qualtrics surveys or town halls, you know, that sort of thing. So I think, you know, Oren and I probably share some view that there's space here not taken by the courts. And the interesting question is just how to fill it in.
Oren, anything to say to that?
Yeah, so I think we agree on a bunch of issues, but disagree on some others. So let me just say, in terms of agreement, I don't want it to. It would be a misunderstanding to think that I'm thinking that people approach it either from the police or from the defendant's perspective. I agree that we should all be approaching this from society's standpoint. We should all be looking at the public interest as a whole. I think my point was only that when we try to assess the public interest, it's just from a cultural cognition perspective, people tend to associate with certain people, and it's hard to kind of get an entire broad neutral sense of society's interest, because a lot of people are going to think they're going to be concerned with public safety, or they're going to be concerned with civil liberties, and they just walk in with those biases, and everyone is going to kind of have a kind of instinct about how to best balance these interests, and that will reflect their little corner of the world. And so I think the problem with this is that, you know, when we talk about Supreme Court decision making, it strikes me as probably inevitable, not desirable, but inevitable, that Fourth Amendment rules will roughly reflect the policy preferences of the median Supreme Court justice. And so over the last 50 years, that was, you know, probably Justice Stewart and then Justice Powell and then Justice Kennedy. And so, you know, that those are three Republican nominees, three moderate/moderate conservative, depending on how you look at them. And a lot of the interests that are the focus of this book are things that are really not on the radar screen of that median Supreme Court justice. These are, you know, to think of it from maybe putting it in the framework of the current Supreme Court, these are kind of Justice Sotomayor-like concerns. There's one member of the court that's very concerned with and focused on these kinds of issues, but it's not where the median Supreme Court justice is. Again, going back to the broader question, what's the baseline? I think the courts will always give us this baseline of the median justice. And then I think it makes a lot of sense for communities going outside of the national Supreme Court, which can only do one size fits all, for different communities, states, localities, to impose greater regulations on the police. Just from a federalism standpoint, I think it's desirable to have a variation in what the police can and can't do in different communities, if they have different senses of what is in the interest of different communities. The hard question, I think, though, is does that apply kind of across the board? I can imagine some cities or localities or communities saying, actually, we think there's too much privacy now, there's too much restriction on the police, and other communities saying there's not nearly enough. And in that case, you know, is the answer ultimately to say this is really about democratic decision making, and we should have legislatures and local community rules govern instead of the courts? Or is this more about sort of making sure there's enough protection, making sure there's enough regulation, and more of a substantive point of sort of what's the best answer? And so I guess a way of putting this is there's kind of a way of looking at the book, which is that it's a procedural approach. And there's also a way of looking at the book where it's more, here's how we get to certain substantive ends that we don't have yet. And I think there's maybe a little bit of tension in the book between the procedural way of thinking about it and more the substantive way of thinking about it.
John, can I say one last quick word?
Yeah, go right ahead, and then we'll start to queue up for questions.
Yeah, I mean, this has been totally interesting to me, and so I guess that's a good sign, because you would think I was sick of my own book already. but I think, you know, the two things I'd want to say is, first, Orrin's right to separate process from procedure, and I really am aiming in the first part of the book for a process approach, and then I talk in the second part of the book about kind of minimal constitutional procedures, and people may disagree with me there. When people ask me in public, you know, what do I think, this or that, I often say, I'll tell you my view, but what I'm really interested in is what everybody thinks about as a whole. And so I think that's important. And then, you know, so the one thing I do say in the book is that I've loved, and we actually hope to do some litigation around this at the Policing Project, and you know this, John, what I'd love to do is try to persuade courts that in some of these instances, rather than deciding whether something's constitutional or not and, you know, maybe getting it wrong, they should be asking whether there's been any democratic input into the matter. And we didn't have to worry about that for many years because policing looked relatively similar. But especially with the zooming technology that we have, there's a lot of adoption and deployment of things that it's just not at all clear that it's what the public wants, that it makes sense. Things diffuse oddly in the policing world, largely by word of mouth. And I've got a gadget, so, you know, my buddy's got a gadget, so I want the gadget. And, you know, that's a space where it would be good if courts thought to invite in public voices, because, you know, the tough part of all this is the inertia of democracy. And I think Orrin's onto something when he says, you know, people hear that the court said something, and then they think, okay, we don't even have to think about it anymore.
Barry, let me ask you a question before we tee it up. I've got a couple, but I want to tee off on something you just said, which is the judges perhaps should invite inquiry about whether there has been buy-in from the public. What would give the courts the authority to do that? And so, you know, they're presented with a warrant for, say, a cell site simulator, a stingray or something like that, and they've got to decide whether to approve that warrant or not, and there are standards for approving that warrant. Where in those standards or rules does it say that a judge gets to ask or would have the authority to say, well, gee, has there been any public buy-in for deployment of this technique in this sort of circumstance?
Yeah, so that's a great question, a hard one, and I will tell you that in addition to book, I co-authored an article with the deputy director of the Policing Project, Maria Ponomarenko, who, if you're all listening from the Academy, will be on the market in about 18 months. And in the last part of that article, we tackle? What are some of the legal grounds for doing this? And, you know, there are a number of things that can happen. They're least likely to happen, I think, in the context of an individual warrant requirement, and that's a warrant application. And that's a great point, John. You know, we give an example from Utah, which is one of my favorite cases, where a guy gets stopped at a roadblock and initially consents to the search of his car and then tries to yank back that consent after they've identified the remains of a joint in the back seat. And then they find a couple kilos of, I think it was heroin in the trunk. And he's both criminal charges against him and civil tax charges. And they're tossed out by the Utah Supreme Court and the Utah Court of Appeals on the ground that the department had acted ultra vires, that there had been no authorization in statutory law in Utah to have roadblocks. And so, you know, that kind of ultra vires approach is one possibility. There are avoidance doctrines. There are cases where there may be, you know, substantive due process kind of hooks to looking at whether there's been any democratic say-so. But I think it's a tough question. It's an important one.
Nate, I don't know whether you want to start to cue things up. I've got another question before we get to others, but do you want to make an announcement about queuing up now, or should I ask my question?
Oh, let's go to the announcement and open the floor so that audience members can get in line if they'd like to. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign.
So, Barry, let me ask you another question. So you've been talking about...
I'm sorry, John. Hold on 1 second. Just a reminder to the audience, if you want to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. And I do have one also one announcement for our calendar before we go to questions. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Monday, the 6th at 2 p.m. That call will be a discussion of the Ninth Circuit case Hardy versus the NCAA, and that it'll tackle the question of whether the NCAA can bar convicted felons from coaching in NCAA certified recruiting tournaments, and it will feature Joshua Thompson, who's a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and it'll be moderated by Roger Clegg, president and general counsel for the Center for Equal Opportunity. Okay, I'm sorry, John, go ahead. We've got a couple people lining up in the queue, and we'll get to those after your question.
Great. So, Barry, you talk about that you see a need for greater, you know, as you call it, democratic governance on the front end for policing techniques, so more involvement and buy-in from the community. So if you would talk to law enforcement officials, as I'm sure you have and I have too, you'll hear a couple of things. And so I want to say what those two things are and sort of get your reaction to that. So one thing that law enforcement, and particularly intelligence officials, will say is, you know, we don't want the bad guys to know what capabilities we have to deploy against them, because otherwise they will take evasive actions in order to avoid being caught by those technologies. And then a second thing you will hear them say is they'll say, look, unless nobody who is not a police officer, unless you're a soldier, can sit in the shoes of police officers, that unless someone actually experiences the threats that they face every day and the adrenaline that goes along with those threats, there is no way to adequately convey to the public the nature and extent of the threats that they face. And it is very often the nature of those threats that dictates what resources and tactics they deploy and when they deploy them. So because that cannot be adequately conveyed to the public, getting public buy-in is going to unnecessarily endanger law enforcement officials. And I'm curious to get your reaction to those two comments that I've heard from law enforcement folks.
Sure. So I first, you know, want to make clear, I, again, spend my days working with law enforcement, and I have enormous respect. And one of the things I've learned after any number of hours in the fronts and backs of police cars is that I can never be a police officer, which only increases my respect and my understanding of the difficulty of the job. I was just on a podium with two police chiefs who don't see it that way, and there are plenty more that I talk to in the sense that they think perhaps we overtrain officers about danger and undersell them in other ways, and that it's important to think about that. So, you know, I'll just give you an example of where I think training might fail us and endanger officers, which is, you know, again, use of force. Think about the Tamir Rice shooting. The cops get a call that there's a male with a gun in a park. The dispatcher's told, by the way, that it may well be a child with a toy gun. But that doesn't get to the cops, fair enough. And they go flying in a cop car, two of them. They pull within just, you know, a couple feet of Tamir Rice. Within 2 seconds, they've shot him. He's on the ground. Well, you know, I've talked to plenty of police chiefs that just cover their eyes and think, you know, oh, my God. Why was anybody trained to go rushing up to the guy with the gun like that when there was absolutely no need to do it? And so, you know, I think we toss around statements like that too easily without picking them apart. The public doesn't know about lots of things that it, you know, there's involvement in formulating policy, whether it's nuclear energy or workplace safety or environmental harms, and we have to do the best that we can to muddle through. Now, I take somewhat more seriously the first thing you point out, and I think it's a tough question, as I indicated at the beginning. You know, there's just a bill introduced in New York in the city council to require the NYPD to post surveillance impact statements before certain technology is deployed. And the quick reaction from the deputy commissioner for legal, who was a friend of mine, was, you know, you might as well just ask us to put this in a terrorist magazine. I think that argument, too, though, runs the risk of being greatly overstated. And what we have to do if we're going to be sane about this is figure out what's the space between what can be public and what we can have an opinion about and what we absolutely can't let the bad guys know. And I often use SWAT as an example here just to say, look, there ought to be public approval of the idea of SWAT teams and how they're armed and what kinds of situations they get called out in generally, but we sure don't want the SWAT team's active shooter policy on the web. And that's the kind of space that we have to find. And, you know, I hate debates that take the form, as they too often do in the public forum, of, you know, you hate the cops and you are in favor of the community, or versus you love the cops and don't really care what happens. I mean, that's not true of any of us, I hope. You know, I hope we all want to be safe and secure and treat people respectfully and have a democratic say in things. And so then we just have to crack tough nuts like that, and we might have to do it technology by technology and find our way. But there are plenty of technologies, whether it's predictive policing, drones, or license plate readers, that we could have plenty of say in without endangering our security one iota.
Nate, should we take some questions?
Absolutely. We have a few people waiting currently. If you would like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to the first caller.
This is John Rowland, Constitution.org. I think we need to address 2 points. One is on the oppressive surveillance evidenced by what Snowden revealed, which has been known to a lot of us for decades, that the Fourth Amendment does not really provide enough protection against what is not really a search, but it's just, as I said, oppressive surveillance that intrudes on our privacy without necessarily searching anybody, and that we are going to need to look for a privacy right against oppressive surveillance in the Ninth Amendment, not in the Fourth, which means that the courts are going to need to be willing to adjudicate Ninth Amendment claims. Secondly, on the question of, let's say, trigger-happy police, one of the problems that many police have is the way they're trained. They're trained to put force protection above public protection. And they simply take the position that any time there's the least suspicion that somebody might have a gun, it's grounds to open up, unload their gun, and kill him. And we need to have alter training to, first of all, assume that everybody is armed and that that's okay because they have a right to be armed. And second of all, that if they do have to shoot, they should shoot to wound or to scare and not to kill unless they absolutely have to.
Yeah, those are fair points. I mean, on the first point, you know, you stick your finger in the very sensitive nerve about what constitutes a search. And that is a question that is under tremendous pressure right now in the face of technological advance. And it is not going to get any easier. Before jumping to the Ninth Amendment, I just assume get more public weigh-in than we already do, because I think that there is a great deal of public concern about surveillance. A number of cities, particularly out west, have adopted ordinances or created surveillance privacy boards of different forms, such as Oakland, San Jose, and are inviting just that kind of regulation. My own view from a constitutional standpoint is that for some of this, like the bulk data collection, what's essential constitutionally is that it's happening to everybody, that that's the protection, and that we know about it so that we can then, if we don't choose to incur those costs, not incur them. I mean, we all seem to be okay with some level of bulk data collection. We don't seem to be okay with bulk DNA collection. And on the training point, I just think you're right, and it's tough because I have enormous sympathy for cops that are out there doing an incredibly difficult job, and people want them to be safe, and they operate in some neighborhoods that are really, really difficult. On the other hand, I do spend enough time with police chiefs who say what you've just said, which is that the training model has pushed very heavily in this direction of, of avoiding any risk, and we understand all the reasons for that, but it has left the balance perhaps not in the right way, and left us resorting to force at times when we could use other tactics, left us resorting to deadly force at a time when there were intermediate levels of force that could be used. But this is a question of developing rules and policies and then training to them.
Warren, I don't know whether you want to jump in or not, or whether you go to the next question.
No, let's go to the next question.
Okay, let's do that.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. George Meade here in Florida. I have two points I'd like to see if I can get responses from both gentlemen. It seems to me one is structural and one is constitutional. It seems to me that all the solutions are being addressed to the problems, both the problems and solutions, all seem to be top-down. And I think that those are reflective of a scaling problem. I don't know if you've read Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, but he made the point that you can't have a Stalin in a municipality. He was looking at the structure of Swiss cantons. And those structural pushing down the structural mechanisms of policing down to the local community level is the heart and soul of the problem that we have here, because people who are in their communities, who are policing their communities, and who are organized and trained in a manner to do so are of the people. You're not going to have activities by and large. You'll certainly have margins to police in terms of their behavior, but you're not going to have activities in those settings that are going to depart too far from community expectations with regard to the kind of federalism Mr. Friedman is talking about that we need to emphasize. Now, those issues are structural, but there's basis for it in the Constitution, and that's my other point, and that I'd like for you, perhaps Mr. Kerr to talk about in light of Bond v. U.S. and the Supreme Court's addressing itself to structural limitations as opposed to parchment barriers, and that is there's only one actual institution in the Constitution which is given the civil duty of executing the laws, and that was the militia, which was a shared institution between the states and the federal government with a very nicely balanced set of powers and responsibilities that was designed, if you read the provision and the history of it, to get at this precise problem. The mode of enforcement before the time of the Secret Service and when the Posse Comitatus Act came out because of abuses of military authority in trying to police civil populations, prior to that, it was the Posse Comitatus under the sheriff or, in the federal context, marshals calling people from the community to go enforce the laws when there was resistance to court process. And it's that mode which we tried to go back to in the 80s and 90s with community policing in the professional police model, but it's that professional police model, I suggest to both of you, that is the problem, because professional police are not sensed as being of the community very often, and in the worst cases, of course, sense as being hostile to the community. Certainly the Black Lives Matter people would say that. Rightly or wrongly, they certainly feel that way genuinely. And there is a reason for that. And those contexts, those structural issues, and tying those back to an institution within the boundaries of our law and history, it seems to me, is the only way to solve this. We're in a populist moment right now, and I think it may behoove us to look at those types of solutions. What are your thoughts?
I'm happy to defer to Orr if he wants to go first, or I can jump in. Either way.
Sure, I'll go. So I think it's tricky to devise a way of having accountable law enforcement in a way that reflects community norms through relying on any particular procedural mechanism or saying, you know, we should have, you know, go back to the common law hue and cry as one way of doing it. You know, it's really tough because notions of communities, I don't think are ones that are widely accepted in the sense that, you know, I live in one town and there are people who live two blocks down from me that I are they part of my community or not? You know, different people are going to have different values. And I think I'm more confident that professionalism as a model and democratic oversight and judicial oversight are workable ways of creating those systems. And I wanted to point out one thing actually that comes back to Barry's argument in the book. One really interesting question is how much oversight do we have of the police? And I have a somewhat different view than Barry does in the book, and that he suggests, you know, we have so little oversight. One mechanism I think that at least produces a lot of helpful oversight is the exclusionary rule, which basically involves a criminal defendant who very likely can't afford an attorney having an attorney appointed for him, who then files a motion to suppress and forces the government to say, this is what happened. And so we get a hearing as to what happened in that case. A judge oversees it. A judge writes the opinion on whether the law was violated or not. I do think the exclusionary rule has a really important role in generating oversight. Not the courts may or may not reach the right answer or say that a certain practice was unconstitutional or not unconstitutional. But the fact that we get that oversight mechanism is, I think, incredibly important to understanding what the police are actually doing. And the excessive force context, which we've talked about a couple of times during the call, are you know, an area where normally excessive force, that's not coming up in the exclusionary rule context. Excessive force claims are going to be, hey, this officer, you know, hit me or punched me or shot me. It's not evidence collection. It's police practices outside of evidence collection. And that's where it becomes trickier to have oversight over what the police do, because we're beholden to civil actions, which can then bring issues before the courts. And then you come into the qualified immunity standard, which you know, blocks so many cases and keeps them from going to trial and prevents, I think, a lot of oversight that otherwise would occur. So I guess I'm just institutionalist. I'm just being sort of status quo oriented and thinking that having professional police and having the exclusionary rule and those sorts of sort of traditional means of oversight are useful, but it's not obvious to me that there are alternatives, especially in terms of professional policing, that are better.
Yeah, I disagree here, and I actually disagree in the space that Warren left open. So I think the exclusionary rule is a terrible way to resolve most of these questions. We could fight about that, but we don't need to. Because, you know, where are the cases going to come from that ask questions about CCTV cameras and whether license plate readers, which suck up, you know, tens of thousands of license plates and therefore location data, should be stored and for how long? And, you know, whether we like predictive policing algorithms and how that data should be used. I mean, the courts are never going to get at most of that. It's judicial review is way too episodic. It doesn't deal with the concerns of most of us. It's why you're starting to see these privacy boards pop up in communities. There's just too much to be regulated to think it's going to happen through judicial review, or that the judges are going to get it right, or have the cases that present the right facts, as opposed to seeing the entire picture. You know, one of the things that concerns me in policing actually is that a lot of the new technologies are incredibly overlapping in what I imagine to be their purposes. I mean, often their purposes are not very clearly specified, and you need to figure out, you know, just from a budget standpoint, like how much you're going to dump into this stuff. It's all very, very expensive. Now, I do think it's a structural problem, and I do think that we should not look at it top down.
It's a problem that we have 18,000 separate policing agencies in this country, and one of the things we will need to figure out in the future is a better allocation of responsibilities for what things should be regional or state, national. You see this sort of in joint terrorism task forces and fusion centers, just this attempt to try to figure out what's the right unit for different kinds of policing, different concerns. But a lot of the work we're doing in the policing project is very down on the ground, practically knocking on doors, getting citizens involved, having them in forums, getting them in rooms with police officials, talking about problems, and we're even doing it with kids. We've got a youth curriculum that we're running in some schools. We're piloting right now in Camden and Tampa, and it's costly, and the mechanisms don't exist. You know, we have school boards and library boards and zoning boards, and we don't have policing boards in most places, but it's not crazy to have them. And I actually think that overall those conversations between policing agencies and the public will yield same results. The public is not usually completely crazy, and there'll be much more buy-in and therefore much more legitimacy what's happening in policing. We won't have what I heard an awful lot of earlier today about, you know, people getting shot and nobody calling the police and nobody helping the police.
Okay, we have a few callers waiting to ask a question, and we're running a little short on time. Let's try to get to as many of these questions as we can.
Yes, thank you very much for presenting this event. This is Bill Otis, and I'm happy to talk with Oren and John, and Professor Friedman, I'm happy to meet you. I teach law part-time at Georgetown. Most of my career was with the Department of Justice. I have three observations about the conversation so far. One is that we've talked for 50 minutes about policing, but not once has the word crime been mentioned. But, of course, there is a big relationship between policing and crime, and I don't think we can sensibly talk about the one without talking about the other. The principal relationship between policing and crime is that, as we've seen over the last generation, when we've had many more police and more aggressive and proactive policing, crime has fallen by 50%. Now, the increase in proactive policing is not entirely responsible for that, but it is a significant factor, which leads to my second point. Something else that has not been mentioned today, which is that there is going to be a trade-off. We haven't talked about a trade-off between the effectiveness of policing and the accountability for which we've heard a great deal today. Accountability, although it sounds like a fine word, we all want accountability just like we all want reform, but it's accountability to a point. What accountability has turned out to mean is scrutiny of the police, and it's scrutiny with an agenda. And the agenda is not necessarily an agenda which would be shared by the public, which, according to Gallup, views the police with 76% approval. It's a sort of accountability that's more popular with lawyers and law professors who, according to the same Gallup survey, have 21% approval. And I wonder if our panel members today could talk about some of those issues, particularly I have in mind the trade-off that we have seen, for example, right now in Chicago, in which there is more police accountability. There's a detailed consent decree on the ground in Chicago. It started January 1st, 2016. It's been there for a little more than a year. During that year, the murder rate in Chicago had skyrocketed to scandalous proportions. And I wonder whether any of our panelists perceive a relationship between the spike in murder and the fact that police are now required to do a great deal of what is called accountability, but for some of us not sharing the policing project perspective or the ACLU perspective, would regard as an effort to tamp down on the ability of the police to do what the public mainly wants, which is to suppress the crime rate. Things are now going in the opposite direction, and I wonder what our panelists would do to get them back in the direction they were going in from 1991 to the end of 2014.
So I'm going to jump in on a
point of privilege, which is that I don't mind being lumped with the ACLU, but it was presumptuous to think that the Policing Project's agenda, which is available on our website, relates to the ACLU's agenda at all. I think they're entirely independent. I think you're right to think that those conversations need to happen together. I think that's one of the great failings of the debate we've had in this country, which is that we don't talk about crime and methods of policing together often enough. We treat them as separate conversations, and we get the phenomenon that you just indicated, though I think, you know, I try to have them together. And in fact, I just did a moment ago when I talked about shootings that happen without the police getting any cooperation. The cause of what's going on in Chicago is very complicated. I mean, I was just sitting next to the chair of the police board, and we talk about it a lot, and I've talked with folks in the mayor's office and in the department. And it's, you know, there's studies that point in two different directions, and I try to give both directions credit and then try to understand what the truth is. So one version of that is that in the face of controversy over things like the Laquan McDonald shooting, and I think less so, frankly, for the stop and frisk consent decree, there's been depolicing, there's been a backing off, and some people say that backing off has led to the spiraling crime. Other people that I talk to say, actually, the problem is that because of those events, people have become even more reluctant to cooperate with the police, and the police are not getting any cooperation. I don't know which is true. I think that it's important for us, if we want to address societal problems, to consider all the available hypotheses and to try to learn something about them. That's actually what we do try to do with the Policing Project, as well as talk to people in communities. When we talk to people in communities, we talk to everybody in the community. We, in particular, always have officer focus groups where we sit down with the officers and try to learn from the officers who, you know, are different, by the way, from the rank and file. I mean, are different from the brass and often have a great deal to teach us. So I agree that we need to listen to everybody's voices here. I don't think accountability is found in a Gallup poll. I don't think accountability is found in electing a mayor who appoints a police chief, and then police chiefs end up moving around like NBA players. I think accountability is a familiar concept to us. We have it throughout government, and we ought to have similar accountability here. And in the work that I've done, people are people. You know, sort of like in New York, we were asked to evaluate the NYPD's body camera policy and from a public perspective. And we went out over a very busy month of outreach, and we heard from 30,000 people and 50 organizations all over the ideological spectrum. And I don't know what the NYPD is going to do, and our report isn't public yet because it is taking them an inordinately long time to get that report out. But I will, you know, dribble one factoid to you, which is that when it is out, you will find that it's actually quite surprising how much the public, from whatever demographic, from whatever part of the city, and you can presume things about income levels from that, how little variance there was in certain sets of views. It was surprising to me and reassuring at some level, and I think if we ask people more often, we might all be surprised.
Okay, very good. We have two callers waiting in the queue. Let's try to at least squeeze in one more question. Go ahead, caller.
I'll try to be quick so the other question can get on. This is Roger Kandaradia. Thank you for a really good presentation.
Could you talk up just a little bit?
Sure, I'll try. Is this better?
Yeah, I'm just having trouble hearing. Thank you.
In the small rural communities, our attitude toward the police as I was growing up was that they were there to keep the peace. Now it seems that they're there to enforce the law. But the law has grown so multiform and confusing, and so many additional crimes, additional federal crimes have been created that it's made it, it's completely changed the model of the responsibility. So this, your earlier caller, first caller mentioned the Ninth Amendment. What about the Tenth Amendment as a way of restoring to local communities much of the, particularly small communities that that don't have the problems of the big cities. They're much more localized, and they can be handled by local people who are of the community, as was mentioned.
You want to jump, Oren?
Sure. You know, I think a lot of the issues we're talking about are happening at the state level, not the federal level. So I think the 10th Amendment concerns are well taken, and I agree there's too much federal criminal law, and it's too vague, and it gives the government a big hammer in a lot of cases, including some when it shouldn't have that hammer. But I think the underlying issues we're talking about are also true at the state level. So I'm not sure that limiting the federal role really changes the dynamic that much.
I mean, I don't have anything to add. I think it's, you know, it is true that there's a lot of law. It's actually interesting. Again, the folks that in the law enforcement folks that were in the room were saying something I hear a lot, which is that they don't love law enforcement as a description of what they do. They think it's, you know, policing service encompasses a lot of different things, but that the focus of their work needs to be understood as much more encompassing, which is not to deny the very serious law enforcement problems in places like Chicago.
Okay, we are pretty much out of time. Let's squeeze this last question in and then move to concluding remarks, if that's all right. Go ahead, caller.
Is there any review for – this is Bill James, sorry. Is there any review or interest in communities for jury review of all police killings?
So, you know, I don't I guess I have two things to say. There's so much focus on the back end. When there are police killings, it obviously makes a ton of sense to focus on the back end, and it's very serious and should be looked at very, very seriously. There was a lot of passion in the room today from folks about criminal charges and grand juries, and I understand that, and there are some cases that we have seen videos of that seem to call out for that treatment. But the problems that you see with uses of force generally are not going to be solved by grand juries. It's a blunt tool. It's the wrong tool. It's what we need to do is get policy straight and have intermediate weapons and proper training. And we could do a lot with those techniques. And that, I think, is what we need to do. And then, you know, what you find with civilian review boards, which we're actually trying to work with some of them to focus more on this kind of front-end community engagement, is they're charged to do investigations after the fact or to review investigations that were done or even to participate when investigations are happening. But those are very difficult things for civilian entities to do and to do effectively.
Okay, Barry, thank you. Gentlemen, any parting thoughts?
Well, let me say congratulations to Barry on an excellent new book. I mean, it really is a thought-provoking read. And it's a fun read. There's not a lot in the area of Fourth Amendment law that's like something you could show a non-lawyer and they could enjoy reading and have fun with. And this book really does count. It's going to be something that gets a lot of attention and should get a lot of attention. And it's going to be a book that starts a lot of conversations. This is just one of many that I'm expecting. So really looking forward to those conversations. And congrats again to Barry for the book.
And I want to start by thanking Oren. I thank him in the acknowledgments. He's been a very good friend to me and to this book. I've learned a tremendous amount from him, both when we agree and when we disagree. I'm glad to hear that it's an enjoyable read, and I encourage everybody on the phone and out there in the world to buy it. That's what authors are supposed to do. I also just want to ask you, if you think to go look at www.policingproject.org. We are deeply involved in this kind of front-end accountability. We are working with methodologists and police departments to try to bring cost-benefit analysis to policing practices, and the departments are hungry to have it. They are very, very eager to have it. We are working with departments in their communities to try to figure out ways to bring in a community voice without displacing the departments in ways that they feel comfortable. And so we would welcome people signing up on our mailing list, following us on Twitter. We're at Policing Project. Don't miss that donate button. And I want to thank Oren and John, Federalist Society. This has been a terrific amount of fun.
John, any final thoughts?
No, I want to echo what Oren said. It's a terrific book, Barry, and it involved a lot of work, and it's going to lead to a very important discussion. So I want to thank you both for participating and for the Federalist Society for hosting this program.
Excellent. The book is Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission, and the author is Professor Barry Friedman. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.